This is Chandradasa from the Buddha Center Online at thebuddhacenter.com, and this is another episode in our series of Buddhist Voices, except it's a special episode because we're starting a new mini-series. We don't know how long it'll last. Perhaps it'll last for decades. Perhaps it'll just last for a year. We've already got Kamala Shila's Quarterly, which you may have seen, featuring our good friend Kamala Shila, who is in the College of Public Preceptors for Sri Ratna Buddhist Order. And today we have his friend, my friend Suvajra, who's also in the College of Public Preceptors.
Yes.
And here we are in the glorious summertime at Adisthana Retreat Centre. And Suvajra's very kindly agreed to do what we're at least provisionally calling Suvajra's seasonal.
Yes, that was your suggestion.
That was my suggestion. And he's so far he's going along.
Why not? Why not?
Suvajra's seasonal's got a nice ring to it.
Yes, they're both S's, aren't they? Let's see where it goes.
I like the idea of meeting you in different seasons and seeing if that affects the conversation. So hello, welcome.
Well, thank you. Nice to see you.
Welcome to the radio, sort of.
Well, nice to be with our prospective listeners.
And what are you up to today? So you can introduce yourself to the world as...
Well, today's been a sort of normal day, though a little bit busy. I've been doing some shopping for Venerable Sangharakshita.
Mm-hmm.
I'm engaged in looking after him, helping look after him. He's resident here at Adisthana, and there are a team of four of us who are just trying to provide a good base for him.
Mm.
And two of that team are away today.
Oh, and so busy day.
It was a bit of a busy day today, yeah. Yes.
And for those of you who don't know, Sangharakshita is the founder of the Tiratana Buddhist Order and community. And he's quite elderly, isn't he, these days? He's in his late 80s.
Well, he's due to be 90, and due to be 89 this next month. Although he's not really saying, he's not really focused on this next birthday. He's focused on the one after that. Because in his mind he's thinking, well, look, I'm nearly 90. Yeah. And that's the conversation that he'll have with you. I'm nearly 90. Not that I'm nearly 89. In his mind, actually, he's very close to 90 and outlived many of his peers.
And yes.
Even some of his juniors.
Wow. And is your sense that he's doing quite well, Sangharakshita, just now? Is he...
He's doing not bad. Yeah. He's frail, very frail.
Hmm.
For a 90-year-old, you know, some 90-year-olds can be very frail, some can be very robust. He's very frail, and yes, I think probably as well as could be expected at the moment. He's under various medications, as people of that age usually are, and at the moment he's been taken off one particular medication, so he's experienced a little bit of cold turkey.
Yeah,
and weathered that and coming through it.
And does he like living here in the Herefordshire countryside?
I haven't asked him lately. I did ask him some months back, you know, if this felt like home yet, and he said no. Mm. And that didn't surprise me, because it didn't look like it was his home to me. He didn't sort of seem to fit into it, as it were, having moved from the, you know, suburban area of Birmingham, where he'd lived for, I can't remember now, but yeah, over a dozen years.
Yeah.
So moving at an advanced stage to a new place, it's a big thing, huge thing.
Yeah.
But I've seen over the last few months that he's beginning to, I think, connect with the landscape, connect with the country, the sounds and so on. And especially more as the retreat centre itself is becoming less of a building site and more of a proper retreat centre.
And you do often see him outside sitting, looking over this rather lovely vista.
Well, in morning time.
Yeah.
He'll go out just after 11 o'clock and sit on the bench overlooking the pond. And he's been doing a little diary recently. So, you know, he'll say things in the diary like, I don't think I'm giving anything away here, but sat on the bench by the pond contemplating the landscape. So, you know, he's there and, yes, he does contemplate the landscape. His eyesight's not very good.
Yeah.
But he looks out and...
And he's there in the landscape, isn't he? Experiencing it.
Yes. Well, and then sometimes in this you know, very sunny weather, he's been going out one or two more times during the day, which is very unusual. Just sitting for 15 minutes in the sun.
Maybe a wee poem will pop out at some point, you never know. A new poem by Bharati, as he's wont to do every so often.
Well, I asked him, actually, just a few days ago, you know, have you written any poems while you've been here? And he thought, said, no, I don't think I have.
Well, you put the little seed in his ear now.
That's just over a year he's been here.
Well, so listen, we were talking before we started the recording about the seasonal aspects of these.
Yes.
And I was interested in if you had any particular memories of summer that we could use as a wee gateway into the life of Suvandra. And you've been in the order for a long time, haven't you? Whippersnapper like me, you've been in the order.
Yes, well, since 78. And it's quite a number of years. I can't even count them offhand just now. I know it's over 30 years. Yes, connecting with the summer season. You asked, you know, are there any summers that you remember and particularly remember? And, well, there is the summer of 69.
Summer of love, I believe.
It was the hippie season, and I was in my final year of school. That's what nowadays would be called your second year in your sixth form college.
Sixth form college. So, what age were you then? About 18?
No,
17.
No, I was the youngest in the class because I had my birthday 31st of August, which is the last day of entry for a school. That should also tell my listeners that I'm a slow learner. Because I was younger than everybody else. But yes, so I was actually 16 in the summer of 69. I turned 17 later on, but when I was 16, there was a chance to go to America with the English-speaking Union in Scotland, and it was, you know, a fantastic three-week trip for £50.
Was this debating, or...?
No, I mean, I was just part of the English-speaking Union, but we were doing... spoken English exam. So English speaking unions advertised around all the schools in Edinburgh and Dundee and probably a few other places. MD would like to go to America, we'll take you across, meet other students, have an exchange student trip. And I'd never really had any ambition to go to America, but I thought £50, and my mum and dad thought, well, yeah, you can go. If you earn the money for spending, we'll pay the fare. I earned £20 and I came back with 10 shillings.
Wow, £20 did you hold 3 weeks in America?
It did. And we had a few days in New York, which I liked. There was a few experiences there. At the end of the trip, we had a few days in Washington. I didn't like Washington so much. But the in-between time, actually, it was 3 weeks in between, was in Kentucky, in Louisville, where I stayed with a family, with my exchange student called Richard Miller. And Richard and I got on very, very well. We got on famously. He was probably a little bit eccentric. And in a sense, perhaps so was I. At least my sort of interests weren't the interests of, you know, the normal other run-of-the-mill young men in, you know, football and rugby and sport and all that. I was much more interested in science and nature and things like astral travel, witchcraft.
Were you a hippie?
I wasn't a hippie.
Were you heading in that direction?
I wasn't heading in that direction, not at all. But I met some people in America in 69 who were definitely hippie. One of them was, we got on very well, we kept in touch for a number of years, called Marcia. She was a dancer. She was the flower power. She was the band around the forehead. She was your archetypal young girl hippie. We got on very well. And she introduced me to Lord of the Rings, of course.
That was the big thing.
Taking off at that time. Richard, he spotted that I was a sort of kindred spirit in some sort of ways. And he had a number of other unusual interests himself. We had a great time in Kentucky. Cut the long story short, he came back to Scotland, stayed with me, and one day he said, oh, you'd be interested in Buddhism. No, he didn't say that. No, first of all, he said, he mentioned his brother being a Buddhist. And I was very surprised. And he said, oh, didn't you know? He's a Zen Buddhist, and he had a shrine in his room. Didn't you see it? I said, well, no, your brother lived down that corridor in the house next to your mum and dad's room, and I never went down that corridor. Richard's room was in the basement. So he said, oh yeah, my brother's a Buddhist. You'd be interested in Buddhism. Now, I don't really know what he saw in me that connected me to Buddhism, but he said, you'd be interested in Buddhism. We should get some books on Buddhism.
And was your family a Christian family? Were they practicing?
No,
were they largely
nominally Protestant? Nominally Protestant. Very mildly Protestant. Perhaps a couple of times in the year going to church. At least at that time.
So he spotted something?
He spotted something. The next day we went down to the bookshop in the city and I picked out Christmas Humphrey's Penguin edition of Buddhism, which has done a fantastic service for Buddhism over the decades. And Edward Conze's Essence and Development of Buddhism. I got home and I had a look at the Penguin Book of Buddhism for 20 minutes, pictures maybe about 10 minutes, and some of the text for 10 minutes, and I announced to Richard, who was reading his books that he'd bought, I announced, I'm a Buddhist. I just didn't know what to call myself, and I've always been a Buddhist. And then I said something which I think is even more strange. I said, and I will die a Buddhist.
That's extraordinary. Now, do you remember anything that you read in the book, in the paper book?
I couldn't tell you a single thing that at that point that I read.
So there was no particular catalyst, it was just the experience of...
I think maybe the catalyst might even have happened before then.
Mm.
It might even have happened when he said his brother was a Buddhist. Just hearing that was in a way shocking. And I felt a sort of a loss of opportunity that I missed speaking to his brother on that subject. I missed going into his room to see his shrine.
And because it sounds a bit like recognition. It's almost like you recognised something. I mean, what was...
I think I did, but it was something in me I recognised.
Yeah, well,
and,
yeah,
and I can't put my finger on it any more than that.
And when you followed up on Buddhism and obviously became involved...
Mm.
When you thought back on that event, could you understand more how it happened, or has it always remained just a mystery?
No, I think by the time I'd actually looked back to examine what had happened, it was already history, and I couldn't put my finger on it. I remember trying to. What was it? The only thing is that more recently, in the last few years, when I've thought about it, I've moved the event back from the reading of the book to actually the first time he mentioned his brother as a Buddhist.
Yeah.
That, in a way, was significant. Something happened then. It may have not just been at the moment of the book. It may have been something, you know, rolling on just in those 24 hours.
Hmm. How did you follow that up? And what was your kind of route into involvement with this particular community?
Well, my involvement was quite slow. In some senses, it was quite slow. The only thing I could do was follow up the book, the recommendations at the back of Christmas Humphrey's book, which was basically an address to the Buddhist Society in London, which I wrote away to. They wrote back very quickly. They gave me a reading list, gave me a membership form. I immediately ordered some books and went to join the Buddhist Society, but it required a signature since I was under 18.
Uh-huh.
Required a signature from one of my parents. So, of course, I went to my mother. And I said to her that I wanted to join, that I was a Buddhist. And I think that was the first time I'd actually said to her that I was a Buddhist. And she's a very sensible woman, my mother, she was. And she said, well, you know, if you're really interested in Buddhism and it's not just a flash in the pan thing, it'll be there in a year's time after you've turned 18.
Hmm.
So... you can sign it yourself then.
Very
so
wise.
I thought, well, okay, that's fair enough.
Fair enough.
That's a fair enough answer.
And the Buddhist Society, can you say a little bit, for people who won't know what that is, was it just a society you joined that you got books from? Did they have a centre of some kind that you could go to?
They had a premises in London.
Hmm.
And for those who lived outside London, there wasn't really very much, not in those days. There was a summer school that they had, which they offered 10 days, which looked tempting. And they had their magazine. But if you were outside London, that was it. So the society was founded by Christmas Humphreys, who'd written this book. And in some ways, I'm not sorry that I missed out on that Buddhist Society part. When I did make some connections with the Buddhist Society, it seemed rather sleepy to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I was looking for something a bit more dynamic, which I certainly didn't get for many years.
Mm.
Actually, they offered a correspondence course.
In Buddhism?
In Buddhism, which I took up.
Oh.
And I was given a tutor who sort of mentored me. And she was very good. We had a little correspondence that went on for a number of weeks. And she recommended, it was actually her that recommended the books, now that I think about it. And I sent off all those books. Now, those books had more of an impact on me than anything in the correspondence course or anything in Christmas Humphrey's book on Buddhism.
Do you remember the books?
I do. One was Concentration and Meditation by Christmas Humphreys, which is basically an instruction manual in how to meditate. I read forward just far enough to learn how to do the meditation on mindfulness of the breath. And I just recognised that's the proper meditation. That's the one. I'd had a look at other things and from other sources, and in 1969 it was a bit weird. Quite strange meditations and so on. But the breathing one, I thought, this is the proper one. And so I started it. And it was on and off, and one day on, one day off, a week on, a week off. It was definitely part of irregular steps. But I kept up from 16 right through until now, doing meditation. The other meditation that was mentioned in the book was loving-kindness, which I had a go at, but the instruction I didn't connect very well with instruction. So that's as much as I read in the book. And it said if you haven't got a basis in these foundation meditations, really you shouldn't be going on to the insight meditations later on in the book. I never read it.
It's quite impressive that they had the loving kindness meditation in there, and that clarity that there was some basis for moving on to something.
Yeah, and I've still got the book, the original book.
You've been a Buddhist for 45 years, by your own reckoning.
You've counted it up.
I've counted it up in the interim. That's what I was doing, folks.
How old are you?
I'm 43. So there you are. You've established yourself as a Buddhist. You've had some input that's given you, I suppose, the rudiments of a practice.
Yes.
How did you find your way to this community? And in a way, did you experience the rudiments of that practice filtering out into the rest of your life? Or was there a bit of a kind of period where you were stuck at the same space or the same level?
Well, I think for 5 years, I was sort of a little bit in the same space, moving on perhaps a bit more. I mean, I was becoming more familiar with the Buddhist system of teaching, system of practice, but I hadn't met any other Buddhists.
Mm.
I definitely consider I had the Buddha and the Dharma. But Sangha? No, I didn't have Sangha. And a lot of other things I didn't have. I didn't have any ritual practice, any devotional practice. And in some ways I was a bit stuck for that. And I remember that when I used to go on little tours, or doing archaeology and all sorts of oldie stuff, I used to visit cathedrals and ruined abbeys and so on. And I used to feel devotional.
Mm.
And I was tempted sometimes, in some places, to dip my hand in the font, genuflect and cross myself.
Because it would be something meaningful.
But why? I mean, I was never a Catholic. Yeah. I never did that in the Protestant church. But it was a ritual that I knew was religious. And I felt this urge to do it.
Well, even if you go to the local village church here, there is a beautiful atmosphere, isn't there? It's something. People have worshipped there for a long time, and that something seems to transmit, doesn't it?
Well, we'll come back to that little bit of that urge I've got, because it's so connected with the story. After 5 years, there was an advertisement in our local newspaper to set up a Buddhist group. And there's a whole story there. I mean, that would be maybe even a whole series. Not just Suvadra's seasonals, but Suvadra's
sagas.
Sagas, yes. So I joined this newly forming group and I was elected chairman. The guy whose idea it was, he was the secretary, and his mate was the treasurer.
And you're still in Scotland?
Still in Scotland. Still in my second hometown. I was born in Aberdeen but then moved to Dundee. Hmm. So this is in Dundee. And here's this Buddhist group set up. And there's six of us, the original members. We stayed all the way through for the next 5 years, more or less. And Ray, who had started up this group, he'd worked out a programme for the season. So it was visiting Aberdeen Buddhist Group, which had collapsed, so we didn't go there. It had folded.
Hmm.
Visiting Edinburgh Buddhist Group, great, we visited. The man there gave us two tapes away with us to listen to afterwards. Both, as it happened, by Sangha Rakshita.
Now, can I just ask, were these groups affiliated at this point to the Buddhist Society, or were they freestanding?
Freestanding independent groups.
What? So there was a whole
history. And there's a whole history in the UK of these little groups that would start up, just 3, 4, 5, 10 people or so, meeting and just doing their thing.
So somebody gave you 2 tapes of Sangharakshita, and this is 74, 75?
This is 73, I think.
73.
And those 2 tapes were revolutionary for me. One was The Path of Regular and Irregular Steps, which seemed to, as many people when they listen to it, the recording of it, they think, he's talking to me. And I had that experience. The John that he talks about, well, John, in his Buddhist career, he finds himself in this situation. And I actually thought, it's like he was right inside my mind. He'd been there. He knew what I was experiencing. So that was very, very helpful to hear that tape and to understand that my practice had been an irregular practice, but nevertheless, it was a path. Even though it was 1 step forward, 2 steps forward, sometimes it was only 1 step back. So it was a path, and I was moving towards more regularity. The other tape was Right Livelihood of the Noble Eightfold Path series, in which he outlines there the issues connected with trying to live a full-time Buddhist life, which is what I was struggling with at that time. Was I going to take my Buddhism further? And how would I do that? Would I work part-time? What would I do? So,
and in terms of your connection emotionally to Buddhism at that point, was there one particular aspect of the broad path that you would have been most aware of as a kind of entry point? Was it an ethical connection to being a Buddhist? Was it the meditation that you'd taken on and managed to at least keep going irregularly? Was it the kind of evocations of Buddhist wisdom that you'd read in books? Was it, what was the kind of mixture with that?
Well, mixture is the right word. It wasn't, I don't think it was any one of those. In a way, I think it was the whole lot. Although I was very, very struck by some of the Tibetan things. So a few of the original books were the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which had been recommended to me, which, of course, I never understood a single word of it, but it was so wonderfully mystical and transcendental that it swept me off my feet. Tibetan Book of Great Liberation, and much more understandable in a sense, the life of Milarepa. And that struck me very strongly as a man living a Buddhist life, albeit a yogi's life, very different from my life, but I could relate to that very strongly. So those 3 books particularly struck me very strongly and remained with me ever since. I'll just take my story a little bit further forward. So we'd gone to Edinburgh, had these 2 tapes, but then the next visit our Buddhist group was to visit a woman called Mrs. K. Turpie at Glasgow Buddhist Group. But by the time we actually got there, it had become Glasgow Buddhist Centre, and that was my first connection with, as it was then, it wasn't Sri Ratna then, but the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order.
Fantastic. Okay, so you've arrived in Glasgow, the first city of Scotland, I have to say, from a partisan basis.
I see.
My brother lives in Dundee, it's a very nice place. And that's all we've got time for right now. The next Vajra seasonal, or perhaps part 2 of this, if we can wangle it, I will hear how you actually entered the community in a way and made your deeper connection, which has lasted all the way through till now and brought you here to this lovely corner of England.
Yes.
Who would have thought it?
Who would have thought it? 45 years after the summer of 69.
And the man whose voice you listen to, we're going to help care for right now. That's why he's got to leave us.
That's right. Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Chandler.
Thank you very much for your time. And I look forward to many more seasons with you. So you can listen to more of these podcasts on thebuddhacentre.com or SoundCloud. Have a search for The Buddhist Centre. And you can listen to the talks Suvanda referenced on freebuddhistaudio.com. That's all from us just now, and we'll see you again soon.